So we're going to jump into steps 4 through 9. If somebody describes steps 4 through 9 as like a golf swing, you start at 4 and you go all the way through 9. And I don't play golf, but I like the analogy. You don't really want to stop midway through. My experience has been a lot of people stop after 4 and 5. And I'll get to that, what my experience has been when we get there. But I'm going to start with 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Interestingly enough, when I did my 4-step the first time, like I said, we did it from past recovery, and I answered a lot of those questions. I could have told you everything I had done wrong in my life. I could have told you why I was the most horrible person on the planet. And one of the things I like about the Past Recovery book is it also made me look at my assets. I could not identify an asset, as my husband would say, with two hands and a hound dog. I couldn't have figured out what one of my assets were. So it was important for me to be able to look at all of me, the good and the bad. This is where my sponsor said the transformation is going to start. It's a transformational process from step 1 all the way through step 12. And what we're doing the inventory, and she called it an inventory. We were going to look at what worked and what didn't work. We're going to look at what tools I had and I was using, and what worked and what tools I had that I was using that were no longer working. She liked to say, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and we want to expand your tool bag. And I was beating the crap out of everything. You know, this is the way to do it. We have to do it my way. That was my hammer. And what she made me look at was the exact, we made a searching and for a fearless moral inventory. She said, fear less. Doesn't say no fear. She said, you're going to have to do a little bit. You're going to be a little afraid, but do it afraid. She used to say that to me a lot. All right, do it afraid. No, I don't want to do it afraid. I don't want to have any fear when I do something. She said, if you take the action, the feelings will change. Do it afraid. And she said, it's a moral inventory. We're not really looking at your actions except to identify your principles. And that was really important to me. When I got here, the first time I did my 4-step, I looked at all the actions. What had I done? What did I say? I didn't look at the underlying principles or the underlying nature of my wrong. And step 5 talks about admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. It doesn't talk about admitting the events. And that was important to me. And I had to identify the nature. And what we discovered when I did the inventory the first time was the exact nature was I was entirely and completely fear-based. I was always reacting to what was going on from a place of fear. I never went into it with the idea of something good might come out of it. I always went into it to worst case scenario. And the worst case was I was going to be abandoned. The worst case was I was going to be left alone. The worst case was you were going to figure out how incredibly awful, horrible I was. Which why it was important the first time I did the steps was to be able to identify some assets. And it's funny because now my nickname is the most resourceful one. I am very resourceful when you need me to be. And my sponsor says, and you use that talent for good and not evil. And that's true. I can use that talent for good and not evil. I used to use that talent to investigate. I used to use that talent to be a detective. I used to use that talent to stalk people. That's what I would do with that talent. And now I use it to be of service, and now I use it to be of assistance. But I started by looking at everything that I had done wrong. And what I'm looking at today is what are my old ideas, my preconceived notions, resentments, and expectations. So early on, I was really just looking at where I'd acted in a way I wasn't proud of myself. Usually involved men. I didn't know how to date. If you expressed any interest in me, I was instantly in love, and we were going to trudge the road to happy destiny. And I would, the reason why Kent ended up with the gas credit card is because the other guy that I was with, I don't know if he was alcoholic or not, but his drinking bothered me. I'd given him a gold MasterCard because what I now know, having done the inventory, is I was trying to purchase his love. I was going to give him everything that he wanted so that he would not leave me. And for me, the greatest gift you can give me is to say, I need you, not I love you. I can make you love me. Who cares? But I need you, because when you say I need you, what I hear is I will not leave you. And that was really important. So I did a lot of things about against my own values in order to basically hold on to somebody, because I wasn't willing to admit I was powerless over it, but two, I was willing to set, I'd willing to give myself up. I was going to throw myself on the sword, because that whole idea is, if you're happy, I'm happy. You know, my happiness is dependent upon you. I'm okay if you're okay. It was much better for me to be with somebody, even if he was a jerk, than it was for me to be by myself, because of all of those feelings that I had. And I didn't know any of that stuff until I did my first inventory. And when we were able to identify the exact nature of my wrongs, was my insecurity and my fear and my judgment, right? Because see, I'm constantly comparing myself to everybody else, right? I'm never coming up equal. I'm always worse than. There may be times I'm better than, but then I'm going to denigrate you even more so I can feel a little bit better. It's that inferiority, superiority complex. I hate myself so much, I have to make myself look good. But I know if you actually know who I am, you'll figure out that I'm a big fat fraud, big fat fake. And I had to identify all of that stuff. And I did it through a four-step. I don't know how people do a four-step without a sponsor. I really don't. I needed her to help me see the exact nature of my wrongs. And so I answered all of those questions from past recovery. I believe there are either 43 or 47 of those questions, but I answered all of them. And then we sat down and read them, all of them. And by the time I was done with that, she had an entire list on one side of all of my assets. She said that I was kind and I was funny and I was resourceful and I was helpful, not in caretaking, but helpful. I was intelligent and I was well-read. She had all these assets and she'd been taking those notes all the way through. And then she identified about three or four liabilities, and she didn't call them defects of character. She called them liabilities, three or four liabilities that basically drove me. Fear was the number one thing that drove me. I was terrified. Insecurity, which came from the fear, because if you knew who I was, you'd leave me. The judgment, because I'm constantly comparing myself to you. I'm judging myself and I'm judging you. She identified those for me. I will tell you, the very first, before I could even do a fourth or a fifth step with my sponsor, I had one thing in my background that I just knew. If she knew about, she was going to say, you are too bad for, no, I cannot work with you. You're a bad, awful, horrible person. And I couldn't do any other part of the inventory until I had made sure that she could handle that. And it's funny to me now when I think about that, because my sponsor, who I adore, can handle all sorts of stuff, but I didn't think she could handle that, because that's thinking all about me, that self-centeredness about all about me. And so we were coming back from a district meeting in Birmingham. I was driving in the car. I really like having what I call car conversations, because I'm pretty sure most people aren't going to jump out of the moving car. And so as we were coming home, going down the interstate 70 miles an hour, I said, there's one thing I got to tell you before I even start my inventory. And she said, okay. And I told her what that bad, awful, horrible thing was. And she didn't go, oh my God, you're hideous. She said, yeah, I bet that was really hard for you. Let's do some work on that. And so we did some work. But what she did right in that very moment, she said, what I want you to do after you drop me off is I want you to go and make an amends to God, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. It's the only time she ever had me do that. She made me go make a direct amends to God and to ask God to forgive me so that I could forgive myself. And that was the very first time I'd had that 4-9 experience right there in one little episode. And I did it. And when I'd done what she asked me to do, I felt that much better about myself. I'd actually taken some action. I felt that much better about myself. So I was able to continue to do the rest of the inventory. So I did all of that. When we finished and we had that list of my assets and they had that list of those liabilities for me, she did not have me burn them. Thank you, God. She didn't have me burn my inventory. Thank you, God. She said, all right, we're going to move on to step 6. I mean, very quickly, we didn't dwell on it. We identified it. We moved on. She said, it's like when you're going to go cook, you open up the pantry and you see what you have, right? What's still good? What can you use? I got flour. I need yeast. I don't have any sugar. Oh, I've got this stuff that's like really out of date. Get rid of it. Go get some new stuff. She said, that's what we've done in your inventory. We've identified what is valuable to you. We've identified what is out of date. We're going to now start working towards, we're going to ask God to help you become that woman that he's calling you to be. We moved into step 6, very quickly into step 6. She did not let me sit. Now, I'll tell you what my experience has been. What I see happening I don't know the adjective I want to use. I've just seen it happen, is people will do in, they'll do steps 4 and 5 and they'll figure out what's wrong with them. And then they'll want to get good before they go to God. You know, I get people call me after a number of, they've been in the program for a while and they'll say stuff to me like, you know, I really feel stuck. And I'm like, all right, well, tell me where you're on the steps. And they're, well, you know, I was working on my 6th step. I said, okay, what happened? Well, either, you know, I just quit, my sponsor moved, I stopped doing this stuff. And I will say to them, well, I know why you feel stuck. And they said, you do? And I'm like, yeah, because you are stuck. You know, people, we lose people. I think we lose people. I don't think we lose people at 3. I think we lose people at 5. And I think the reason I say that is because people do steps 5, 4, and 5. We are a group of people who are self-reliant. We are a group of people who can get stuff done. And I think what happens and what people tell me happens is now that they know what's wrong with them, they're going to fix it. And then they're going to go to God. So when I have my sponsees say, well, I'm working on this, I'm like, no, 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 we don't need you working on it. We need God working on this. Not you, not you. This is not yours. So my, the analogy I use about steps 6 and 7, we're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. Entirely ready. Doesn't say entirely willing. It says entirely ready. I think that's a big difference. Willingness just implies I'm willing for you to do it. Ready implies I have to take some action to be prepared, right? I'm a runner. When I got here, I was entirely too big to run. And I wanted to lose, actually, I wanted knee surgery because my knees hurt. And the doctor said I was fat and I needed to lose some weight. And those were his words. You're fat, you need to lose some weight. I wanted the easier, softer way, which was have the surgery, fix my knees. And he said, if you lose some weight, you'll feel better. And by God, he was right. It was remarkable. But it meant I had to take some action. And when I started running, I couldn't actually run more than 30 seconds. I had an idea in my head. I should be able to run 3 miles the first time I run. Now, that's that insane thinking that I still can have, you know. And I don't know why I thought I could run 3 miles. I'd never run 3 miles, but I thought I should be able to. That whole idea of should. So it goes back to where am I currently agnostic on that step too. I should be able to do this. I don't need to turn to a power greater than myself. And so my husband got me a big giant stopwatch and I would run for 30 seconds and I would walk for 30 seconds. And I did that for about 5 days. And then I would run for a minute and then I would walk for a minute. And I did that. It was 30 minutes a day. I did that for 30 minutes a day. And by the end of the first month, I was able to run 2 miles at the end of that month. And that's my experience. The same thing with these steps. I have to become entirely ready. The way I say it is somebody will say, all right, I'm entirely willing to have God remove these defects of character. All right. If I were to say to Debbie, hey, Debbie, I'll pay you $1 million if you run the Boise Marathon next Saturday. Debbie may say, for $1 million, I'm willing to try. Right. But she wouldn't be entirely ready. She wouldn't have her registration. She wouldn't have her shoes. She wouldn't have trained her feet. She wouldn't have trained her muscles to be able to run 26.2 miles. So there are things we have to do. And that's what that step 6 is. Step 6 is to get entirely ready to have God remove the defects of character. And for me, the way God gets me entirely ready to have him remove these defects of character is he does it in 2 ways. The first way is he has that defect of character just pop up all the time until I get tired of it. I mean, it just keeps coming and coming and coming. And I'm like, I'm done. I'm fine. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. The second thing he does is he gives me an opportunity to practice a new behavior, right? It's not enough for it to be removed. I need, because it's been a tool, I need to know if I'm not going to do this, right? I need to know what I'm going to do instead, right? When my sponsees call me up and they say they've done this or they've done that, I say, all right, what would you have rather have done instead? Or what will you do the next time? What's your plan for the next time? Because I do believe these defects, I don't believe for me that God pulls the defect of character out like a weed. He doesn't eradicate it and yank it right out. It's gone. You never see it again. Because I think it's transformational and because I think it's spiritual, I think what happens is this is who I was when I got here, right over here. And as I continue to do the work, I move away from who she was to over here, to who this woman is today. Right. But these defects are still here. And if I don't keep doing what I've done to get here, I'm going to go back to here and I'm going to go back to what's familiar and I'm going to go back to what works. Sarcasm is a huge defect of character for me. When I get afraid or I get defensive, I get sarcastic. right? And so that was a defect. I had to be entirely ready for God to remove. And I saw how sarcastic I was, but then I had to practice other things to say instead of the sarcasm, right? I learned to say, huh, wow, interesting. And I must have learned to say, wow, really well, because about a year ago, Kent sent me an email and I said, wow, and he emailed me back. He said, is that a real wow or the Al-Anon wow? I said, no, that's a real wow. But I had to learn to say other things than that. You taught me how to say you could be right. I'm sorry you feel that way. I didn't have to argue with him about everything, but I didn't have to react to him. Those are defects of characters of mine, but you have to tell me, teach me how to do things differently so that when the defect was removed, I had something to replace it with, right? Because if the defect is just gone, I don't know what to do differently. And that's what I think 6 and 7 does for me, is it allows me to learn how to do things differently, right? What to do differently, how to say things differently. Do I need to say anything at all? I love the acronym, WAIT. Why am I talking? What am I thinking? That's a huge one. And in the book, How Al-Anon Works for Friends and Family, I think this is one of my most favorite pieces of Al-Anon literature. And this is probably my most favorite paragraph. It says, and this is at step 6, right? After a lifetime of self-sufficiency, most of us need to be reminded that there are limits to what we can achieve alone. We can achieve without help. Paradoxically, by accepting our limitations, we can avail ourselves of unlimited possibilities. With God's help, we can overcome seemingly impossible obstacles. Miracles can grace our lives, and serenity can take the place of despair. Our defects of character can be blessings in disguise, because in order to be free of them, we must deepen our faith, and the spiritual depth will bless our lives. I often say to people when they call me and they tell me so-and-so is driving me insane, I say, oh, they're your guiding light. And they're like, what? They are your guiding light. They are the ones showing you what you need to work on, because it's never them. If I could do any Al-Anon slogan in the world, it would be, it's not them. It's always me. I remember early on, Kent had got his sponsor had given him this little sticker that he put on the bathroom mirror. And we had a bathroom that was probably the size of this desk. It was very tiny. And this little sticker said, you were looking at the problem. And for about 6 months, I thought to myself every morning and every evening, God, that is so good for Kent. God, that is so good for Kent. And the morning I realized it was me. Oh my God, I'm looking at the problem. I am my own problem. I am the one. It is my thinking, it is my actions, it's my behavior, it's my feelings, it's my thoughts, it's my words that get me in trouble. And that is such freedom. Because if it's me, I got a shot at changing me. If it's you or it's them, I'm never going to be able to change them, right? And I'm always going to be looking at them to be different so that I can be okay. That's that being right, being free. And that's where it comes for me at step 6 and step 7. You know, and step 7 is humbly ask God to remove them, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. Doesn't say he's removing our defects of character. I also think Bill Wilson was a wordsmith, and I don't think that this is a mistake, because I don't think the character defects go. I think they are always with us because we're human. I think I have shortcomings that can be removed, and I can change, and I can be different, and I don't have to be the woman that I was. The interesting thing about that is I also think that God is going to remove my 7th step prayer. The prayer that I say every morning is, my creator, I'm entirely ready and willing for you to remove from me every single defect of character, old idea, limiting thought, and negative behavior that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength to go from here to do your bidding. I say that prayer every morning because it's very important to keep myself grounded. I want him to remove my defects of character, my old ideas, because my old ideas are what get me in trouble. The main old idea that gets me in trouble is I know best. My main idea is I just need to help you. The thoughts that tell me I can't, I should, you need to, all of those things, those thoughts, and my negative behavior, you know, my sarcasm, my judgment, my snappiness to service workers. We tip very, very well, and I am very, very kind to service workers. That's part of my ongoing amends for when I was such a nut job before I got here. I remember the first trip Kent and I took when we were in recovery was we went home to his family for Thanksgiving, and I had my wedding album in the suitcase. And we were at the airport, and the flight got canceled. And I was standing in line and waiting, waiting. I didn't have very much time in. I think he had maybe 2 or 3 months in, and waiting and waiting and waiting. And I got to the counter, and the woman said, "All right, are you traveling alone?" And I said, "No, I'm traveling with my husband." And she said, "Really? Where would he be?" And I turned around, and Kent was at the furthest wall in the airport that he could get from me, because he thought I was going to turn into a screaming lunatic, and he didn't want to be associated with me, right? I'm like, wow. And then when we got to DC, our luggage did not arrive. And I knew between the time we got on that plane, and that's how he saw me, and the time we got to the airport, and they said, "Your luggage is still in Atlanta, we'll deliver it." I said to Kent, "What's the address?" He gave the address, and I said, "All right, well, you know, let us know when we get it." And he looked at me and he said, "Who are you and what have you done with my wife?" Because that's how I was. And so for me, I'm humbly asking God to remove those defects, those shortcomings, but I have to take different action, right? He's got to show me how he wants me to act. And he's not going to remove the defects of character or the shortcomings that make me uncomfortable. He's just not. That's not what it says to do. He's going to remove the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and to my fellows. He's not even going to stand in the way. He's not even going to remove the ones that stand in the way, my way, the way of my usefulness. I want to be of service, right? That is why I think, having been profoundly and deeply affected by the family disease of alcoholism, I will always be profoundly and deeply affected by the disease of alcoholism. I will never get so well that I don't need Al-Anon, because if I did, I'm no longer useful. We connect to each other in our brokenness. People ask me to sponsor them or to take them through the steps because they can relate to some experience that I have had. The women that I relate to in program are the ones who have had the experiences that I have had. What I said to you earlier on, that I don't change in meetings, but I get inspired to change in meetings. I want to know how to be the best version of me that I can be. I want to know how to be kind and loving. My sponsor said to me, the purpose of us working the steps was so that I could become that woman that God calls me to be, he's created me to be, and he challenges me to be, and then I could act like her. Oftentimes when I've called my sponsor and I said, "All right, what do I do in this?" She says, "Who is that woman you're called to be, you're created to be, and you're challenged to be? How would she act? We know how you would act. How would she act?" And I had to make a list of how I wanted to act in certain circumstances. I remember calling her early on, probably in the first 5 years, which was early on to me, just complaining and complaining and complaining about Kent. "Oh my God, he doesn't do this. He doesn't do this. He doesn't do this." And she said, "Make a list of all the ways you want him to treat you." And I thought, what a great list. I love that list. So I made this huge list of all the ways I want him to treat me. I met with her. I read it to her. And she said, "Great. Now you treat him that way." I'm like, "What? What? No, no, no. You misunderstood. This is how I want him to treat me." And she said, "Yes, if you want him to treat you that way, you have to treat him that way." And that was a foreign concept to me, but that's part of the six and the seven. I have to treat him the way that I want to be treated. And I think for me, I want, because the steps have given me an opportunity to develop my principles and my values. And I talk with one of my dearest friends in the program about living a principled life. I need to know what my principles are. And this is where I begin to find out what my principles are. If I want to be a loving woman, then I need to act like a loving woman, not so that you will love me in return, but so that I can learn how to be a loving woman. If I want to be a respectful woman, I need to treat you with respect, not so that you will treat me with respect back, but so that I can learn how to be a respectful woman. That's what I do in six and seven, is I start to identify those principles that I want to live by. I believe that everybody on the planet lives by principles. They may not be my principles. I believe a lot of people live by the principle of me first, me always. That was my principle before I got here. That's not my principle today. But I learned to identify where those principles are, and I learned to do it by taking the different action. Having done that in six and seven and asked God and start, and I've started to practice these new behaviors and let go of the old behaviors, that's where the transformation really begins for me, as I start becoming that woman that he's called me to be, that he's created me to be, that he's challenging me to be. I said to somebody the other day, if this program was easy, our rooms would be packed. Now, I am really impressed that we have 142 people on here on a Saturday afternoon. I think that is fantastic. But if this program was easy, we'd be meeting in stadiums. you know? It's not easy. It's simple, but it's very difficult. And I think a lot of people settle. And what I've discovered through doing the inventory work is, one, I'm a very greedy pig. I want it all. I want as much as you can give me. I don't want to settle anymore. I settled for so long and I sacrificed myself for so long. I don't want to do that. And one of the things my sponsors taught me is, if it's good for you, it'll be good for them. And if it's good for them, it'll be good for you. The God of my understanding doesn't say, well, I'm going to give this to Corey and poor old Debbie, she's just going to get the locust today. You know, she don't get it. There's a finite amount of good stuff. And if you get some today, then you're going to get crap tomorrow. That's not the way the God of my understanding works. But in order for me to continue with the process and in order for me to continue to be okay with me, I have to do steps 8 and 9. You know, I said we lost a lot of people at 5 because now that they know what's wrong with them, they're going to get good before they go to God. Right. I then think we lose people at 8 and 9. And I think we lose people at 8 and 9 because for me, the four horsemen for me was rationalization, justification, defending, and explaining. I would never have done any of the things I had done if you hadn't done what you had done. Right. I would never have said what I had said if you hadn't have said what you had said. If you just understand where I'm coming from, you will know why I've done what I have done. Right. So I had to be willing to look at my part. And I don't like the term my part, because if there's a part, if I'm assessing a part, my part is always going to be less than your part. Always. You know, your part is much bigger than mine. That's at rationalization, justification, defending, and explaining. But where have I caused harm? Where have I done damage? I like that. Where was my mistake? Where did I make a mistake? Because I didn't do a lot of stuff intentionally, but I did make some mistakes. Where have I caused harm? Whether I intended to or not, you know, there's a line in the big book that talks about even though our motives were good, and I need to remember, I did a lot of stuff because I thought my motives were good, right? I thought I was helping. I thought I was being kind and loving. What I know today is I wasn't helping. What I know today is I was stealing my husband's experiences. I was stealing his dignity. When I say to my husband, I'm only trying to help, what I didn't realize I was saying to him was, what he was hearing me say is, because I think you're too stupid to do it yourself. I'm only trying to help suggest to him that I don't think he can do it on his own, right? Suggest to him that I think he's pretty much a dumbass. And that's not how I want to be with my husband. I love my husband. My husband is brilliant. My husband is not mechanically inclined. We know that, right? So I need to be aware of that and not expect him to do stuff that he's not prepared to do, if that makes any sense at all. But I need to own what I have done. I need to take responsibility for what I have done. When I made my first list, damn near everybody I'd ever come in contact with was on that list, because I thought if you had been exposed to me, I must have harmed you in some way. I must have done, the mere fact that you knew me meant I'd done some damage to you. And that's why it was so important to me to work with a sponsor. There is a question in the past recovery when you get to step 7 that says, if you haven't gotten a sponsor, what would encourage you to get a sponsor? And I think to myself, every time I read that question with a sponsee, how do you get to step 7 without a sponsor? I don't know how you do it. I couldn't have done it. I needed my sponsor to point out more clearly who I was. I couldn't see it. The disease of alcoholism has affected my vision. So I made that list. I had everybody on the planet on that list. And what she made me do with that list was, she made me then write out beside everybody. She let me make the list. Who I owed the amends to, why I owed the amends to them, and what did I think the amends looked like. And when you write that list, the way, at least for me, when I got to the point in that list where I realized why I owed them the amends, I thought I owed them the amends because they knew me, I began to have a sense that I had an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, that I had an over-exaggerated ego, that I thought I was so powerful I could destroy somebody, right? And that's why it was important that she didn't let me get rid of my fourth and fifth step, because she said, add to the list of your liabilities. Now that we're beginning to actually have some experience of what they are, start adding to them. Overdeveloped sense of responsibility, overdeveloped sense of expectations, overdeveloped ego, all of those things. She made me write it. And why did I think I owed the amends? And then I sat down with her and I read those lists to her. And what we ended up doing was we took a lot of people off of the list. We left a lot of people on the list, but we took a lot of people off the list. And she gave me some, and I am one of those people. I put God on the top of the list because I came to this, to the program with the idea that there was a punishing God. There was a God who was a very judgmental God, and that he had a list. He had the good girl list and he had the bad girl list, and I was on the bad girl list. And so my idea about that was I was just going to pretend like God didn't exist. And maybe God would pretend I didn't exist, and we'd, you know, keep our separate ways. But you've been talking to me about this God of my understanding, this higher power who wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. What I have discovered through the process is I do not believe there's a good girl list or a bad girl list. If there's a goofy girl list, I am definitely on the goofy girl list. I spent an entire year where my sponsor made me embrace my inner goober. Because I didn't know how to be spontaneous. I didn't know how to be fun. When she told me I needed to learn to be spontaneous, and I needed to do something spontaneous once a week, I said, okay, I will do something spontaneous on Thursday. And she said, all right, I need you to look up the word spontaneous. You don't get to plan it. I'm like, what? How do I not plan? I'm a big planner. And so when the COVID hit last year and I had all these plans, it was like, So I'm giving an opportunity to work through the plans. But she said, your job is to walk in the direction of your dreams. Where you end up is up to God. Let go of what you think you should be doing. And I learned to be spontaneous. She taught me to learn to embrace my inner goober. If you look in my desk, I'm like a seventh grader with a bazillion Sharpie pens. Love my pens. I have all sorts of different color pens. If you look at my books, I have got all sorts of different color highlights. Look at all the little tabbies I have on my Courage to Change. I like all the little, I'm like a seventh grader, for God's sakes. I did a spiritual practice last year of not buying anything for the month of January that I did not absolutely need. And at 4 o'clock in the morning on January 1st, I thought to myself, I can't do this without more Sharpie pens. I must have some Sharpie pens to get through the month of January. That's my obsession. That's how I am. So anyway, I needed to make that list. I made the list. My husband was on the list. My mother was on the list. The guy before Kent was on the list. God was on the list. I was on the list. Because what I discovered in doing the inventory process was I was harder on myself than anybody ever was on me. I beat the crap out of myself on a regular basis. I denigrated myself on a daily basis. They used to say early on, if you want self-esteem, do things that are esteemable to you. And I needed to start practicing that. And I needed to start making amends to myself. And I needed to start making amends to God. And the way that I made amends to God was I went to God and I told him how I had thought and what I had thought. I wrote a lot of letters and I read them to God. And I did a lot of different things to make the amends. I want to talk about three of amends things that I did. Then, of course, because step nine is that, so we made a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And amend means to change. Amend means to make different. It doesn't mean to apologize. And then step nine says, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I was not given the luxury of saying, well, that would hurt me, so I can't do it. There was only one circumstance, I don't even think it was one, in which my sponsor said, you qualify as another and you don't have to make that amends. She never told me I didn't have to make an amends, ever. What she always told me to do is once we had been through the list and once I knew who I needed to make the amends to and why I was making the amends, and we talked about what did the amends look like, then she gave me permission. And she gave me permission to go out and start making the amends. And the first amends, I remember going to my husband, who was much further ahead of me in the steps in AA than I was in Al-Anon. And I remember saying to him early on, when are you going to make an amends to me? And he said to me, I'm trying to be the best husband I can be to you on a daily basis. That's my amends to you. And I felt about this big, right? But when I went to make the amends to my husband, I needed to tell him that I gave him a job to do that wasn't his, and that was to make me happy. And that I'd put all this responsibility of the relationship on him. And when he didn't do what I wanted him to do, I blamed him. And I would do my best not to do that. And when I made the amends to my mother, I started to have this conversation with her about not being the daughter that, not being present as a daughter to her. My mother loves having dinner on Sundays. She used to love having dinner on Sundays with the whole family. even if I was there, I wasn't actually there. You know what I mean? I'd be thinking about somebody else or something else and not actually present, not participating. And I started to have this conversation with my mother about not being the kind of daughter that I thought she deserved. And she said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about. We are not having this conversation. We are not talking about this. Stop. Don't. My mother is English. She's very, very English. She did not want to talk about any of this. And I went to my sponsor. I said, what do I do? She won't let me make the amends. And she said, you've attempted to make the amends. Now what you do is now you get to act like that daughter that you wanted to be, that you should have been, that you get to be now. And as a result of that, it is remarkable to me how the God of my understanding works. Because, you know, today, my mother lives directly across the street from us. Directly across the street from us. And as a result of that, I get to do a lot of stuff for my mother. When the whole, they started opening up the vaccinations for 75 and above, my mother is 85. And I started calling. I started making phone calls. And it took me probably a good 6 to 7 hours. I got her an appointment and I called her. I said, hey, I've got you an appointment. And she said, oh, that's lovely. And then she talked to me a couple of days later. She said, oh, yes, you know, I was talking to my friend Richard and just told him how easy it was for you. You just made one phone call, got me on one list, and I got the appointment. I'm like, okay, that's not exactly what happened. I did not say that to her. I'm like, but it's not exactly what happened. I spent hours getting you this appointment. Nonetheless, I get to be the daughter that she deserved then and that she deserves now. And what I've realized is the God of my understanding will say to me, even if you don't get what you think you wanted, you will get exactly what you need. Because as a result of Kent and I not having children, I get to be present for my mother. I have siblings who have their own children. They are scattered to the four winds. There is nobody here but me. So if I had children, I would not have the ability or the attention for my mother that I get to have. And that is a gift that I am given. And Al-Anon has given me the opportunity to see it as a gift. So one of the ways we make an amends that I make an amends to my mother is before the pandemic, we would take her out to dinner every Sunday, wherever she wanted to go, which is always very difficult because she would say things to me like, oh, I don't care wherever you want to go. Very difficult, but we'd take her out for dinner. When the pandemic started and Kent and I were both teleworking, we decided, my mother likes cappuccino as well. So what we decided to do was we bought a very expensive coffee maker and we started inviting my mother over for cappuccino. We were all at home. And so she would come over at noon every day and have a cup of cappuccino. And then in the evening, she would come back after dinner and we would watch some BBC murder mystery. She's British. She grew up in London. And so during the course of the pandemic, we have been through 22 seasons of Murder, She Wrote. We have been through all the Endeavor seasons. We have been through all the Death in Paradise seasons. We have been through, I cannot tell you, we are not television people. We've watched pretty much every BBC television show you can see. And to this day, I have been back in my office working full time since mid-August. Kent has been teleworking 2 to 3 days. He was teleworking all the way up till January. Beginning in January, he's going in 2 to 3 days a week. But all the way up to this point, if he's home during the week, he will call my mother and say, come for Cappy, and she'll come over and have a cappuccino, right? Now that we've been vaccinated and we can go out for dinner, we'll say, where do you want to? Oh, I'd like to go to the Mexican restaurant. So every Saturday, we go to a little Mexican restaurant and we have lunch at the Mexican restaurant. Are we going for lunch this week? And I'm pretty confident, even though I was not home today, she and Kent have gone to the Mexican restaurant because that's what they do. That's what you guys have taught me how to do, how to make that amends. She doesn't know I'm making amends. I know I'm making the amends. When she calls me, she had a reaction to the first vaccine. And she called me and she said, I'm sick. I was able to go over. I was able to call her doctor. I was able to go pick up anti-nausea medication for her. Able to get her Gatorade. Able to get her water. Take care of her. So when I took her yesterday for the second vaccine, I said, do you have the medication? Do you have? Yes, I've got it all. We've been checking on her. She's fine so far. All is well. But that's how I make an amends to my mother, right? It's not about saying, hey, I'm sorry, I was a crappy daughter. I get to be a good daughter. Who is that daughter that God's calling me to be? How would she act? She checks in on her mom, all right? The other amends I want to talk about is the guy before Kent. He's been on my amends list since the beginning. His name was Mike. His name is Mike, to the best of my knowledge. I think he's still alive. But I lived with Mike for 2.5 years. And his drinking bothered me a lot. And I basically sacrificed myself for him. But I did it because I thought he was supposed to make me happy. And when he didn't make me happy, I punished him. I forced him to sign a legally binding contract, because I have the ability to do that, where he needed to pay me what I thought he owed me for 2.5 years. Told him if he didn't pay me, I would tell his new wife who I was and what he was like. I basically tortured the man for about 2.5 years. If he hadn't paid me by the fourth day of the month, I would call him and say, you have until 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon to pay me, or I'm calling her. I mean, that is not a really nice place to be. And so when I got to my amends list and I had him on the amends was not just for me torturing him, but because I punished him because he didn't make me happy. I gave him a job that was not his to do, which was make me happy. And when he didn't, I tortured him. And that's the amends. And that's what I need to do, make that amends. And he's been on my amends list from the beginning. And my sponsor said, he's remarried. This may not be the opportunity for you to make this amends. I think what you need to do is pray about it and ask God that if you were to make the amends, for him to put this guy in your path. And I said, okay. And I had to write the whole amends out. It's in my God jar. And I started saying that prayer. And about 5 or 6 years after I'd said that prayer, I was sitting sitting in court one day, and the defendant standing in front of us had the same name as this guy. Wasn't the same guy, but he had the same name. So I thought, huh, this is interesting. So I Googled the guy while I'm sitting there listening to this proceeding. Out of nowhere, for the first time in all the time he's been on my amends list, his work number comes up, his cell phone number comes up, his email address comes up, his physical address comes up. I was like, oh, it's a sign. It's a sign. So I leave, when we get done, I go and I call my sponsor. I said, it's a sign. I know exactly where he is. And I'm supposed to be in that town in 3 months to speak. I think I'm supposed to make the amends. And she said, all right, pray about it. Put it in your God box. Tell God if you're supposed to make the amends, to let him know. Don't do anything. We'll talk about it the week before you're supposed to go. I said, okay. I was convinced. I was absolutely convinced. So the week before I'm supposed to go up there, I said, all right, I think I'm still supposed to go up. And she said, all right, find the cell phone number and call him. So I get on my computer at my desk, type in exactly what I typed in before. Nothing. Nothing. No email, no nothing. So I race into the courtroom because I'm sure if I'm on that computer, it will come up. And I'm, nothing. It's not there. I can't find it anywhere. And I called her. I said, I can't find it anywhere. She said, then you're clearly not supposed to be making any amends. I'm like, really? She's like, yeah. If it's not that, if it was there and it's not that, you're not supposed to make the amends. You just need to be entirely willing, and you are, but it is not time. Came to find out a few years after that, through periodic searches on Facebook, during that period of time, he was separated from his wife. And I choose to believe that had I called him during that period, I would have interfered with whatever his path was. So God said, no, you don't get to make this amends at his expense. So he is still on my amends list. And I'm prepared to make the amends if and when he appears. But I'm not, this is one of those circumstances where my sponsor says, you cannot make this amends if it's gonna cause harm to him. Because you don't know if it will cause harm to him in his marriage, you can't do it. Okay, fine. Last fall, there was another guy on my amends list that I need to make an amends to, because I basically stalked him and tried to get him to leave his relationship for me because I wanted him. So I tried to get him to leave the relationship he was in. Didn't understand anything about, he was a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand anything about alcoholism. I would say things to him like, well, have a glass of wine. He'd say, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I'd say, well, it's just wine. It's not like it's alcohol. I mean, I was an idiot. But he'd been on my amends list as well. And out of nowhere in the fall, I got a text message from him saying, I need to talk to you about, he was looking for a mover or something stupid. And I called my sponsor and I said, he's on my amends list. She said, I call him. So I called him and he answered, oh, I'm so glad to hear from you, blah, 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 and talking. And I said, look, I owe you an amends. Says, oh, darling, you don't owe me an amends. No, I owe you the amends, blah, 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 blah. And I realized in the midst of the conversation, he was drinking. And I was like, oh my gosh. And so I did all I could do to make the amends, gave him the information they wanted, said, nice talking to you, click, hung up. And I called my sponsor back. She said, you're done. You don't have to worry about it. And then I started getting a flurry of text messages from him. Flurry. I mean, you need to call me right now. You need to call me right now. I'm so sorry that I let you go. You're the only one I should have held. I mean, it just got progressively worse, right? And so by the time 6 o'clock rolled around, one, I showed them all to my husband and said, all right, this is what's happened. I didn't have any reason to hide any of that from him. And he said, he's drinking. And I said, I think so. And I talked to my sponsor, and she said, you don't have to respond to any of that stuff. I'm like, great. And I have not, I never responded to any of it. I've not heard from him since. And that's fine, because I know that my side of the street is clean. I have done what I needed to do to make my amends. I've done everything that I can. And then I continue to be willing. If something comes up and I need to make the amends, then I continue to be willing about that. So that's why I say steps 4 through 9 are like a golf swing, right? That I try and do, I look from what's my defect of character, what's my old idea, what's that limiting thought, to sharing it with my sponsor, raising it out, asking God to remove it from me, help me to show me what I need to do instead, being entirely ready, practicing new behavior. If I make the list, do I own amends? And if I own amends, make the amends. 4 through 9, right there. Very easy. Doesn't have to be incredibly complicated. But for me, the amends is not an apology. Because an apology, I said I was sorry about all sorts of stuff. Sorry about the weather. I'm sorry you feel bad. I'm sorry that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. That doesn't change anything. I need to amend my behavior, which means I need to change my behavior. And if I change my behavior, I will change. Not only will I change, my feelings will change. Right? I don't have to react anymore. I can pause. I can pause and say that prayer in step 6 and 7. God, remove from me anything that stands in the way of my usefulness. Should I be useful here? How can I be useful here? I believe we connect in our brokenness. So a lot of that stuff is going to stick with me, but I don't have to act on it anymore. That's the gift for me today, is I don't have to act the way that I acted before. I have tremendous amount of compassion for her, for that woman that I was when I got here. Because I did the best I could. I had no information. I was dumb as a rock. But I was profoundly and deeply affected by the family disease of alcoholism. I like to say alcoholism makes me stupid, because I think it does. It affects my thinking. I will always be profoundly and deeply affected. But I've got a bunch of tools now that I can use, which are steps 4 through 9, as well as 1 through 3 and 10 through 11 when I get there. But I have these steps I can use, so I don't have to act like her anymore. I have compassion for her, but I don't have to act like her anymore. Thank you, God. Not only thank you, God, I don't have to act like that anymore. People don't have to be subjected to me anymore. You know, I talk to the people at the checkout stand. I am not on my phone. Somebody calls me as I'm walking into the grocery store, I will say to them, I'll call you when I get out. I do not talk on my phone. I am respectful to the people in front of me. I have a number of times I have made telephone conversations, called people, like in particular in the past year, in which I've had to call and cancel airline reservations and no refund. No, it's a non-refundable ticket. And I've called and I've been nice and said, well, yes, we can do something. No, we can't do something. All right, fine. If they can, great. If they can't, great. We were supposed to go to Germany in December. And I waited as long as I possibly can to see if we could go, and we couldn't go. So when I called to cancel, I said, look, I need to cancel this ticket. She says it's non-refundable. I said, yeah, I know, I understand that. I said, but you know, you did cancel one of my flights. You rebooked me, but you did cancel one of my flights, and you booked me 3 or 4 hours later. She said, oh, we canceled one of your flights? And I said, yeah. She said, we'll refund you the whole thing. And they gave me the money back for my ticket. They gave me the money back for Kent's ticket, because I was nice. You know, if I'd called up and said, you need to do, no. The other thing I've learned in a recent inventory that I did, one of the defects of character I had no idea I had was I am defiant. I had no idea I was defiant, right? And what I discovered is I'm really defiant about Kent. If he says to me, you need to do or you should do, wouldn't matter if I was waiting to do it. I'm not doing it because you're not the boss of me. I turn into a toddler with my hands on the hips. You are not the boss of me. I am not doing that. And I said to him, oh my God, I've discovered I'm defiant, particularly about you. And he said, do you know how to fix that? I'm like, no, how do I fix that? He said, just do what I tell you to do. And I said, you clearly do not understand the definition of the word defiant. But what it did for me is when I discovered that I was defiant, it has given me a tremendous amount of compassion and realization. Pretty much everybody on the planet is defiant. If I say to pretty much anybody, you need to or you should, their first response is probably going to be, oh, no, I don't. That has changed how I communicate with all sorts of people, all sorts of people. But I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't been looking at my part in that. I hadn't looked at how I react to that. And as I know how I react to that, I can be so much more generous and compassionate and kind and detached towards other people. I think we're at 3:49. I'm going to stop there, and we'll have a 10-minute break, come back at 4 o'clock my time, which is 3 o'clock your time, and then we'll start at 10, 11, and 12. Does that work?